This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, welcome to the New Books Network podcast. I'm Halalia Dean. Would you like to introduce yourself?
My name is Valerie Hebert. I'm a professor of history and interdisciplinary studies at Lakehead University in Orillia, Ontario, Canada.
We are here to talk about the book that you edited, Framing the Holocaust, Photographs of a Mass Shooting in Latvia in 1941. Would you like to give an overview of the book and how it came to be?
Sure. So a number of years ago, I organized a workshop at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington on the topic of atrocity photography. Although it was at the Holocaust Museum, we broadened our focus to include images of other genocides, mass crime. And I invited scholars from various fields. There were a number of historians trained in different fields, but also we had a legal scholar. We had a photojournalist, war photojournalist turned anthropologist. We had literature specialists. And we were all in some way engaged in researching atrocity photography. And part of our workshop time was presenting our individual projects to each other, but we also used our time to look at archival materials from the Holocaust Museum. And what I noticed was that the most interesting conversations happened when we were all looking at the same material, because as a function of our training and of our academic background, different things would stand out to us about the images, and we would bring different questions, different insights to the images. And I thought we really had struck on something that I hadn't ever seen, you know, published before. And so that's where the idea took root, that we would collaborate on a volume where all of us would be examining the same photographs. And I chose these photographs because they are exceptionally rare within the vast collection of Holocaust photographs. These 12 document a shooting that took place in Latvia on a beach called Skeda, just outside Liepāja. It's a port city in Latvia, on the 15th of December, 1941. And they document the sequential steps in this mass shooting. And what's rare about them is that the 12 of them survive together. We'll never know we'll never be able to quantify the full number of Holocaust photographs that exist. A million would be a low estimate, but so many were taken by amateurs for their own reasons and, you know, are still hidden away in attics and dresser drawers that we'll never be able to understand the full measure of the visual record. These 12 were taken, they've been linked to four people. They were discovered in a bureau drawer in an SS officer's quarters, whether it was his office or his home. There's still some confusion about that. They were discovered by a Latvian Jewish man who had been tasked with installing or fixing some electrical outlet in this space. He opened the drawer, saw the negatives, held them up to the light, and understood what it was that what these photographs were, smuggled the negatives out, had prints made secretly, smuggled the negatives back in, hid the photographs for years, and himself miraculously survived the German occupation. And when the Soviets arrived to liberate Latvia, he turned them over to investigators then. So that 12 were taken of this event, that those 12 survived together, that we can identify the time and place that they were taken and even identify some of the people pictured. This makes them an incredibly rare collection. And so for their rarity and for their historical the fact that we can document so much about their history was the reason why we, both of those things were the reasons why we I chose to put these photographs at the center of the book.
And you also write that you were really interested in focusing specifically on atrocity photographs. Why was that?
We deliberately restricted our attention to atrocity photographs because it's those kinds of images that push us to the limits of what we can bear emotionally, intellectually. And those are the images that ask the most pressing ethical questions about how these photographs continue to circulate, and the responsibilities we as researchers and educators might have in how we use those photographs, display them, teach with them. I came to this whole area, this whole research area, because although I'd been teaching Holocaust history for over 20 years, and although I used images of atrocity images when lecturing on, you know, the world wars or on, you know, post-war situations, I had a real ambivalence about showing suffering and dead Jewish bodies in the classroom. And I took that. I had worked with a professor at the University of Toronto. He himself was a survivor. He'd lost many family members in Europe, and he couldn't bear these photographs. He said, you know, that's too much. It's disrespectful to show them. And I really took that to heart. And I simply left them out. Although I used photographs extensively in my teaching, that was a line I didn't cross, but it was photographs that had actually inspired my interest in history more broadly. And I kept coming back to them. I thought there's something about these photographs that are still so compelling. And it was my own desire to work through their place in understanding this history, in teaching this history, and in researching this history that brought me to the field of Holocaust photography. And my contribution to the, one of my contributions to the volume is making that argument about why we should engage these photographs. So there are important ethical arguments against them. For a start, these are photographs that were taken by perpetrators. The photographs themselves are a separate part of the cruelty that was inflicted, right? It's not enough that they were ripped from their homes, brought to this place, made to undress, and then killed, but that they were also photographed in that process is like an extra layer of torture and humiliation, right? So the photograph itself is an artifact of that cruelty. Among the ethical arguments against engaging with these photographs is the photographs exist because this cruelty was inflicted on these people. And so in continuing to look at them or display them, are we not continuing that cruelty? Are we not re-violating those people? We also, just as a dynamics of, as a function of how photographs are made, when we look at those photographs, we actually stand in the same position that the perpetrator did, right? We sort of reenact that unequal and exploitative relationship that the perpetrator had vis-a-vis the people he was photographing. That these people, they never gave their consent to be photographed, that they're captured in these moments of total vulnerability and exposure and humiliation. So we should be aware of those kinds of arguments. Those should be in our mind when we engage them. And it's not that those concerns go away, but there are also so many other reasons that support continued engagement with these photographs. And it's something that I think this book achieves, not just in sort of the ethical arguments that move us towards engaging with these photographs, but also the various chapters show us just how rich these images are for sources of insight and understanding. And they show how many stories these photographs tell, right? That initial story, the one created by the perpetrator when he took that image, is not this single and only an exclusive narrative that attaches to these images.
Right. I do want to go back to that. I have one question about the book in general before we get into kind of the content? And maybe the answer is nothing, because this book came out of all of the NOW contributors sitting in a room together. But as the editor, was there anything that was surprising or noteworthy once the contributions started coming in about how the volume came together?
I don't think so much that there was something new that came out of this for me, because again, it was building on a conversation that had taken place and in ongoing conversations, me with the different contributors as the as their chapters took shape. You know, the quality of the contributions is excellent. And I was so, you know, what started as just sort of us talking around a room, that they could, you know, translate that to the page was wonderful. And I wouldn't say I was surprised by the quality, but I was gratified, and I was validated in sort of having faith that we could collaborate on this kind of project and produce something truly unique and excellent. So one thing I will say about the process, even just of my own writing my own contributions to it, the other part that I wrote was introduces the photographs themselves and researching all the different ways they'd been captioned by various archives, and simply, you know, conducting these searches on the images themselves is, you know, getting an insight into just how many versions of these photographs exist, that they've been cropped differently, that there's different, obviously different prints made of them, that different versions of them exist in different places. And so it tells me that, you know, copies circulated even before, you know, these 12 were handed over to the Soviets. And also just in returning again and again and again to these images over the course of years, as this book was coming together, I would find new things. Right. And it wasn't just from, you know, the contributions of the different authors who, you know, again, they're noticing different things and elaborating on those in their chapters, which would, you know, spark something new for me. But even in my own, you know, re-engagement with these images, you'd notice different details, you'd see how they fit together in different ways. And that was, there was this, you know, ongoing process of discovery, even, you know, one would think after I'd already sort of understood everything about these images, seen them so many times. In fact, they still just gave and gave and gave in terms of their richness and complexity.
Right. I want to go back to this core ethical question. I think throughout the book, there are two strands of complication that are really, I mean, there are more than two, but two that are quite prominent in a lot of the contributors' arguments. And one is that one of the ethical complications is simply engaging with these photographs, period, given the kind of suffering and vulnerability in them. And the other is the way that the engaging with the photograph puts you in the view of the perpetrator. And it made me think of a collection that I know quite well, which is at the archive that I work at, that I will link in the episode notes. But it is this collection of this Jewish Historical Commission that went out to document pogroms between, I think, 1918 and 1921, primarily in Ukraine. And they collected names and statistics and things like that, but they also took an enormous number of pictures, many of which have survived and we've now digitized and put online with no restrictions. And it made me wonder about your thoughts about these. You know, these are not perpetrator photographs. These were Jews with a goal of documenting atrocities. And does the fact that when we're looking at kind of the shooter's view, if the shooter is not the perpetrator, if the shooter is really striving to document, and in their view, that documentation is a sort of justice oriented, how does that complicate these ethical questions? I mean, I think I think a lot of the ethical questions of just viewing, right? I mean, mass graves, I think those still stand, but how much of it to you is the fact that specifically the Skeja photographs are taken by perpetrators?
That's an excellent question. And I think it gets to the heart of so much of what we can and should understand about photographs hinges on understanding the circumstances of their creation, right? And so a suffering body taken, a photograph of a suffering body taken with a view to trying to, you know, alert a wider community to some kind of crime or persecution in process, right? That it might prompt some kind of intervention, or to document for posterity. You know, the motives for that kind of photograph are so completely different from the photographer who takes a picture where it's to humiliate in the moment, it's to celebrate in the time after, it's to revisit for some kind of, you know, personal titillation. That completely alters, right, how we understand that image, even though the actual visual content might look very similar, right? Broken bodies, naked bodies, a crime, you know, actually unfolding before the lens, right? So the visual information might be similar, but its meaning is different. And even the same photograph can have both meanings. So for example, you know, the Skeda photographs were no doubt taken by, you know, the perpetrator, you know, a member of the perpetrator group. They're given the focus on naked or nearly naked women and on children in moments of you know, extreme terror. There seems to be some kind of added preoccupation there. It wasn't just documenting a successful shooting, a well-organized shooting, but, you know, there's some kind of fixation on those particular aspects of the day. You know, it simply adds to the sordid history of those images, but looking at those and understanding what it is that they document, that same visual information becomes an indictment of that crime and of that photographer's impulse, right, to try and immortalize that kind of suffering. Yeah. You know, I think also, you know, similar to the photographic projects you described to document the pogroms, you know, there were efforts, you know, life-risking efforts undertaken by photographers in the ghettos, for example, Mendel Grossman, Henrik Ross. These were professional photographers who were employed to take official photographs for the Jewish councils, but in secret and at great risk to themselves, also sought to document the experience in the ghettos. And I'm thinking of some photographs taken by Mendel Grossman of the, it was a Jewish family whose job it was to collect human waste in the ghetto. And they were literally covered in excrement themselves. I mean, it was one of the most terrible jobs, most dangerous jobs because of the risk of disease and, you know, the kind of work that was so debasing. And yet the father in speaking with Grossman said he actually wanted those photographs taken. He said, you know, let us be captured like this, because there was a sense that this should be documented, that there should be some kind of record, some kind of memory of this. And there is something that is just so undeniable about photographs, right? The photograph exists because the thing existed, the scene existed, right? So that sort of one-to-one relationship of the item to, you know, the scene is transcends language, time, geography. I mean, they understood it at the time that those images were made, and that's that same quality that continues to compel our attention now. And so I think we need to take seriously the that persecuted Jews themselves wanted those photographs to be made and to exist. And, you know, when I think about, you know, the photographs at the core of this book, we have them because a Latvian Jewish man risked his life to preserve them. You know, had he not done that, it's very unlikely we'd have certainly all 12. As I said, it seems that prints were made and circulated. One popped up in a trial in the 1960s in East Germany. So we might have seen here or there, but to preserve this 12 and to be able to identify the people pictured in them, we owe that to Zifkon, right? To David Zifkon, who discovered the photos and preserved them. You think also of the four photographs that were taken in Birkenau by a member of the Sonderkommando and smuggled out to the Polish underground. Again, at enormous risk. And we see too there images, you know, some of those images include naked women on the very brink of being killed. So, you know, the visual overlap or the thematic overlap is very clear. That so great a risk was undertaken to take those photos and preserve them. I think that also bestows on us a certain responsibility to have the courage and the fortitude actually to engage them.
Right. Because it's very difficult to, I think part of the power of putting the fact that, and again, this is throughout the book, this idea that in looking at the photograph, you are in the shoes of the person who shot the photograph, mm-hmm. that feeling that you yourself are now violating these people is a reflection of the fact that they were violated, and having this strong emotional reaction to that is powerful and appropriate.
And I think that feeling should linger. I would be, if you read this book and came away thinking, then I can look at these photos and not feel conflicted, I would say then I've missed the mark, right? Because, and it's something that I try and get at in my chapter, that just because we might come to the place where we understand what these photos can offer us and understand, you know, honor, right? The desire of Zifkon that they be known, that they be understood, you know, as different authors lay out in their chapters, there are ways of engaging these that actually restore agency to the people pictured, right? That, you know, as a record of an event that the Nazis would otherwise have wished to deny, right? I mean, all these reasons exist for continuing to engage these photographs, but they're not redeemed, right? We don't feel better about them. And, you know, when we read Holocaust survivor accounts, and indeed also accounts of survivors of other genocides, right, a theme that I've noticed, it's something that I introduced briefly in my chapter, is that having this knowledge, you know, of this experience, having these memories, continues to burden them. And then we also, you know, share in that burden in if we have the courage to listen to them, to take these stories in, right? So it's not that the pain is less. It's not that that sense of ongoing violation entirely disappears. But sort of alongside with that, we can see how these photographs continue to be important and continue to have things, valuable things to teach us and offer us.
That, I think, leads nicely into one of my questions, which is this phrase documentary photography, which of course comes up quite a bit. In the context of these photographs, would you call this documentary photography? If so, what are the limits of that? I mean, there's, I think, a really, to me, impressive amount of consideration of the perpetrators. I think a lot of times when people look at photographs, it's very, here's what we're getting from the visual image in front of us. And contributors write about the pornographic elements. Something that struck me was this idea that these photographs were taken because perhaps there was just a pride in the work, right? Like, these mass murders were the work and they were doing a good job and they wanted to document it. You know, we talk about how the photographs were distributed, sort of like souvenir cards. Mm-hmm. So I guess, can these be documentary photographs for us and have other purposes other functions for other people who have engaged with them? Is documentary photography even a useful phrase? I just, there's a lot there. And I have now asked like 7 questions. Feel free to pick anyone.
No, that's all right. That's all right. You know, to my mind, documentary photography is actually sort of neutral, right? To document something, you know, to make a record of something. I think, you know, what that actually means has a lot to do with the motivation for that recording, right? So, you know, the German photographer taking these photographs and something, you know, it's explored in the book. What are the possible motivations here? We don't really know why these photographs exist. We just received them. And yes, it could be that this was an exemplary shooting action. It was a larger one. The scale of Einsatzgruppen shootings, this skewed towards, you know, a larger one. It took place over 3 days. It was very well organized. And the kinds of photographs that were taken, the choices the photographer made, there seems to have been a deliberate attempt to document the process from, you know, when the Jews arrived at the site to their actual death. And so it suggests, right, an attempt to try and actually document a successful, well-organized shooting action. There is testimony that there was a delegation of high-ranking military officials visiting the site, right? So there's sort of even more reason why there was like some...
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Standout reason why this should be documented in this way. But then along with that, was this photographer also documenting things that spoke to his own particular preoccupations? I mentioned before the focus on women, on naked women, on children. And so whether that spoke to his own appetites or to some appetites that he knew others shared, I mean, we just know it was common practice for photographs to be traded and shared. And, you know, even the soldiers, SS, they would make albums and they would include photographs even of events they hadn't themselves been part of or witnessed, right? That there was a certain kind of collecting impulse of these kinds of images. And so, you know, that was that part of the impulse in taking these photos. Those were ones that, you know, there was a market for. But then those very same photographs, I mean, nothing changes about them, but, you know, us approaching them today and understanding the circumstances under which they were created and understanding, you know, with the understanding of the Holocaust, you know, that we've gained over the intervening decades of historical research, those very same photographs document the cruelty of this event. They restore actual, you know, faces to what otherwise are kind of these abstract numbers, right? These sort of identityless figures. That they, you know, tell us something about the pitilessness of the perpetrators, right? That, again, it wasn't enough that they were killing them, but that they also had them endure the humiliation of being photographed, right? So it tells us more about, it documents something about the perpetrators as well. And so, you know, documentary photography, sort of returning to the initial question, I think is kind of this neutral term, and what's being documented depends entirely on the motivations of the photographer at the time, and then on the positionality of the viewer afterwards, right? What it is that we understand and see from these photographs, which might be the actual opposite of the photographer's initial intentions.
Right. It's there, and then it in some ways lives independently of the creator.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
I want to pull out one thing that you said, because I think this is a really interesting element of the book, this idea of restoring identity to the identityless. There's a really interesting process that happens for these photographs after they are, you know, given to the Soviets in one piece. And can you just talk briefly about how we know what we know about the people who are identified to varying degrees of certainty?
Mm-hmm. Well, so David Zivkon, who first discovered the negatives and had the prints made, he recognized some of the people that were captured on film. He survived the Holocaust because, or the German occupation, because he was hidden away along with 11 others. And one of those others was a man named Kalman Linkemer. He knew some of the people who were in those photographs. He saw them as well. And when they were handed over to the Soviets, both Zivkon and Linkemer were interviewed, and they interviewed other locals and gathered up some information that was were those initial steps in identifying some of the people in the photographs. And then in the time afterwards, other efforts were made to try and identify the people in the photographs. What's interesting is when you, and it was for this reason that I included the different captions that have been assigned to the photographs by various archives, is there's conflicting information. The same person is identified, you know, or multiple identifications are assigned to the same person. In another case, it's clearly two different women, but they are consistently given the same name. And so this question of identification is a slippery one. There have been other efforts in Dan Newman's chapter. He discusses a film, right, where a relative of David Zivkon actually took the photographs to police agencies in France that had the technology to try and visually match, you know, photographs to other known photographs of these same people. We were able to obtain pre-war passport photos and match them up. But all of this is just, I think, so important. And it's very difficult to do. With most Holocaust photographs, they are these quasi-orphans, right? Where we don't know who took the photograph. We don't know where and when it was taken. We don't know who was actually captured on film. But we've been able to provide identities to so many of the people who are captured in these photographs. And that's rare. And that goes a long way to piercing that intractable figure, 6 million, right? And I think it's a way that we can personalize and individualize, you know, the experience of the Holocaust. And I think that's what really can have a great impact on readers of the book, or on people who are interested in this history, when they can individualize that experience. I think then it hits at a much deeper level.
Absolutely. And I think as an archivist, this really speaks to me about the power of these collections. The fact that we have 12 photographs from the same roll, you know, you need those 12 photographs in a row, you need those passport photographs, you need all these related materials that really build on each other to be able to say this is not, you need them side by side to say this is or isn't the same person. That is so absent from so much of, if we think about the big conceptual archive of the Holocaust, just completely missing. It really just, again, just the general goal of the archive, period, but speaks to why these photographs are so remarkable as an object of study.
Absolutely.
In somewhat of a different direction, not talking about people at all, the ocean figures prominently in some of these photographs. And one of the contributors, Danny Hoffman, writes, "The ocean is rarely incidental in modern photography." I think this is also especially important because I don't want to say the erasure of the Holocaust and how it played out in the Baltic states. There's plenty of information to be found, but I think the average person's conception of the Holocaust is really, you know, woods, Europe, or Eastern Europe, mass industrial killing sites. And I think there's much less understanding of the Baltic states, these later mass killings, the Holocaust by bullets. And I don't want to ask a leading question. So I'll say for me personally, I was struck by the sight of the ocean in for a lot of the reasons that Hoffman writes that the ocean is striking. Mm-hmm. And I just want to ask more broadly about how the sense of place plays into viewers' understandings of the photographs and how that impacts their understanding of what was carried out.
Yeah, it's the beach is an atypical landscape for the Holocaust. It's true. I think when most people, you know, picture it, it's camps or it's ghettos, it's urban settings, it's built environments, it's barbed wire and barracks. But you know, the Holocaust by bullets is a lesser known aspect of the whole trajectory of the history. So even that, you know, I think is will be new to many readers. But even if they do understand something about that phase of the genocide, again, it's more closely linked to forests or fields. So the beach is an atypical landscape. And I think, you know, when we think about what's the beach in our understand, it's like a place where you go on holiday, right? It's a place for families to spend time with each other. And so there is that juxtaposition between, you know, the beach and, you know, this mass murder that's actually being carried out there. I think, you know, and Danny Hoffman talks about the beach setting, but also Dan Magalow's chapter, right, speaks directly to this quality of the images and reminds us that, you know, further back in literary tradition, the beach was a place of foreboding, of danger, right? And then it sort of only later becomes a place for leisure and family time. I thought, you know, one of the really fascinating things that he brings out in his chapter is, you know, the links we can draw between, you know, holiday photography and these photographs, and there are continuities in the way that these images are framed. And I'm sure, you know, listeners, readers will identify with this. You go to the beach, what do you do? We take a photo, right? And what you line up with the ocean behind you because you want the water to show. It doesn't matter, you know, like you want it to be clear you're on a beach. And what do we have in these photographs but the perpetrator lining these people up? And, you know, like there's something, they're half dressed, you know, there's distress on their faces, like something's not right about this, but there's like these reflexive habits, right? In the way that this photographer framed the image, this is the image he wanted to preserve. And it so closely mimics the kind of, you know, like innocent, you know, happy beach photography that we all understand or remember, you know, have some experience with. And I think, you know, there's a deeper significance to be understood there that, you know, I've been teaching Holocaust history for over 20 years, and most students come to the class thinking, you know, that perpetrators had to be forced to do this, right? That it was against their will, and it was only under threat of death that they, you know, raised their guns against innocent Jewish people. And they were, you know, completely conflicted about this. And you know, the evidence doesn't support that assumption. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, you look at these photographs, for example, and like that he could take a photo, like that he could take a quasi holiday souvenir photo from that scene speaks to a lack of internal conflict, right? Like that are these photographic habits, right? Even just that he wanted to make these souvenirs, that he wanted to preserve these things, and that he uses the same kind of devices and tropes, right, in creating those things, that there is much more continuity to be found between the, you know, pre-war, you know, traditions, habits, impulses, whatever, and, you know, what exists even in those moments of, you know, extreme violence and distress. So,
right. This is everyday life, and those kind of habits would continue. It wasn't an exceptional day
That's it. That's exactly it, right? And that's when you situate these in sort of the larger, visual history of the Holocaust, people photographed what they found interesting. People photographed what was important to them. People photographed the things they wanted to remember. Right. And that hints at, and in the absence of being able to speak to the photographer and trust that we're getting honest answers about their motivations, these repeated patterns, right, tells us something about the normalization of this violence and of this experience, right, that those impulses survived even into war and genocide, that desire to preserve and remember and revisit, right, even these horrific scenes, tells us something about the mindset of the perpetrators and of these photographers.
I think more than one person quoted Sontag on this, and I will paraphrase it poorly, but basically that people don't take photographs in unhappy moments, that they they're occupied in unhappy moments. These are everyday scenes in a way. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. That I want to ask about continuity in a different way. So one of the chapters is from Hilary Earle, who talks about the pedagogy of using these photographs and Holocaust photographs in the classroom. And she talks about the ways that she contextualizes them in relation to sort of modern, I would say, genres of photography, like big game hunting trophy photographs. Are there any other connections that you would draw between the SCADA photographs and more contemporary types of photographs we are making and circulating today?
Perpetrators continue to photograph their victims, so that genre of photography continues. Photojournalists continue to seek out those images that actually document, suffering and death, right? And for some, consciousness raising purpose, for some in the interest of justice or legal documentation with a view to, post-fact, ex-post-facto prosecution. So we see similar kinds of photographs being made. Students, I'm thinking about the age of students in my classes. The pornographic element of these photographs is, and the fact that they were taken and circulated without the person's consent is something that they readily understand, right? That they understand that kind of vulnerability and the humiliation involved and the harm that does in the moment, and that continues to exist even when that person is no longer with us, right? That they
there's some responsibility in the way we're engaging with them, even if they're dead, even if it was a long time ago. Yeah.
Well, and it's a thought exercise that I conduct in my classes and even with myself and in that working through of, what really justifies our presence here and looking at those is, if that were me, if that were my grandmother or my child, and that was the only visual record that still exists of that person, or myself, would I want it to exist? Would I want people still to look at it? And in my chapter where I work through this whole argument, there's a place where, and I remember writing it. So I focus on one photograph in the 12, and it's the only photograph where one of the subjects is actively trying to hide from the camera. She's a little girl, 10. Zarella Epstein was her name. And it's the photograph where, four women and this girl have been lined up, drawn out from, where they were made to undress. And it was very clearly a orchestrated, staged photograph. This photographer, he put them together, lined them up, coordinated them looking at him. The level of interaction that must have preceded this image is greater than what we see in the others. And she's hiding. She's has her head bowed and she's partially hidden behind her mother. And to me, that was the photograph that asked the most pressing question, like, How she's hiding. How can we justify looking at this? And, you know, I work through the arguments sort of for and against it. And towards the end, I say that photograph rescued her from oblivion. We know her name because that photograph exists. And as I wrote that, I felt my own blood run cold. And I thought, that's a conclusion that I think will probably anger some readers. And it's something that I was speaking about earlier, like the discomfort doesn't go away, right? But we have this record of her and of her suffering.
And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, that it's so searing, you know, more than, you know, we can imagine that scene having played out. We can read a verbal description of that, but to see it, I think, you know, it's blistering power with that image. And where I come to is that there is something worthwhile that truth was documented, that it's something that we still can engage with. And it's, I don't expect everyone to agree with me, but I do hope at least that the book lays out enough that readers will at least have a more nuanced understanding of these issues and be able to think through their own positions with a little more complexity.
I totally agree. I also think for Sorella Epstein, for this little girl, you write that this was an act of defiance, which leads me to our final question. I will say I agree with that read. And I think having this record that this 10-year-old girl in some way in the minutes leading up to her murder was able to resist in some way what this perpetrator wanted, I think that is, if that's her only legacy, this is the only sort of physical legacy, or, you know, maybe her birth certificate is somewhere. That's a different thing. I do think that is, reading that and writing about it and honoring it is really a powerful way to engage with her and her very short life.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that brings me to my last question. Understandably, and there's no way to avoid this, throughout Framing the Holocaust, the contributors are making these sort of assessments. I don't know if that's exactly the right word, but it's close enough, of what the subjects in the photographs may be feeling. There's a lot of this person, there's terror, they're looking at the camera steadfastly. And even within the book, some people interpret the same figure in not contradictory ways, right? Somebody can be in terror and confused at the same time, but in different ways, for sure. And I was wondering, just on a personal level, how you think about your own positionality and how that might affect the way that you interpret affect in these photographs.
Mm-hmm. It's an excellent question. I can't remember the first time I saw these photographs, because some of them appear over and over again in publications, in museum exhibits. Like when we were looking at the series of 12 at the Holocaust Museum, it was like, oh yeah, I know those ones. But then to see the full set, I mean, seeing the full set was new. But that said, there was never a time where I saw them and didn't understand they were connected to the Holocaust, that, you know, what I was looking at were Jewish victims, and right. So there was always some historical context that helped me to understand what it was I was seeing. And like, I was never at risk of sort of that perpetrator, right, perspective of, you know, like the...
Well, they're also, sorry, just real quick.
Yeah.
I remember now, I think it's Hillary Earle. I will go back and confirm for the notes, but one of the contributors talks about showing these photographs in a classroom, the beach photographs, and asking the students what they think is happening, and the students think it's a day at a beach, you know. So there is, aside from your own, you know, understanding, there's also just the general understanding that it's a Holocaust photograph is really, of course, key.
Yeah, and that's already, like, that's so much further ahead, right? I mean, so yeah, Hillary Earle, she has her chapters on pedagogy, and she introduces these photographs, and she starts with the one, and it's of members of the Grinfeld family walking on the beach, and they're walking towards the actual shooting site, but to a newcomer to these photographs who hasn't seen them and doesn't even, he hasn't even been told they're, you know, it's a Holocaust photograph. It's a family on, you know, it's like mother and children on a beach. And it's sort of only like with a few more seconds looking at it, like, okay, something's off here, right? They should look happier. Or like, why are they all sort of walking in a row? Or so it's like the unsettling, there's something unsettling about them, but that emerges more slowly. So, you know, taken in isolation, some of these photographs do not necessarily suggest Holocaust. So, you know, it speaks to the importance of having some kind of historical context, right? To, and one's own viewing position may have more or less of that, you know, when they first see the images. There was something else I wanted to say. Yeah, the positionality, like I come back to, you know, what I was describing before about, yeah, if this was my family, if these were my loved ones, I think, you know, I would have a different kind of relationship. Or even like, I'm not Jewish myself, you know, so I'm not as intimately connected to the community, you know, represented there. So, mm-hmm. You know, I understand that there's a certain, I am a step removed, you know, several steps removed, but it, you know, some significant ones where, you know, there might not be the same response, and also just being, you know, a scholar of the Holocaust, where I have been studying this material for, well, now going on 30 years, this fits into a kind of, you know,
you have a framework.
Well, you know, I have a framework that, so, you know, I can't look at these photos without that, right? And the fact that I kind of, they've always been sort of part of that visual repertoire for me for this history. And so, you know, I can't look at them with totally naive or fresh eyes. So I can't speak to, you know, all the different ways they might strike people. But, you know, it was one of the things that we achieved with the book, I think, is to demonstrate for readers that the perspective of position, right, informs so much about what we obtain from these photographs.
Absolutely.
And that this conversation could continue, right, that we could bring in so many other different perspectives on this. And in fact, that, you know, one of my larger goals with the book was that this is the kind of method that should inform our analysis of historical photographs, you know, beyond the Holocaust, beyond this book, that they are such incredibly rich and complex sources for insight and understanding, that the more perspectives we can bring to bear on them, the more they can reveal to us.
I think that's a great place to end. Thank you so much for taking the time for this interview. This has been so interesting, and for me, so generative, and I really do appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Hillel. I really appreciated the questions.